All right, hi, and welcome to another episode of Fresh from the Hill, Inside Stories of Noteworthy Cornellians. My name is BJ Siasoko, class of 2007, and I'm here today with Katie Bartels. Katie is a jewelry designer and owns her own eponymous brand, Katie Bartels. Her jewelry is inspired by her world adventures and love of color. The color palette of her collections is heavily influenced by the work of modern artists such as Ellsworth Kelly, Charlie Harper, Frank Stella, and Dave Hockney. Katie is also a graduate gemologist and currently curating the Edward Metzger Gem Collection at the Johnson Museum. She resides in New York City, hooray New York City folks, and finds great joy spending time exploring the city's museums and galleries. And she's a great collector of bold color geometric modern art. Welcome, Katie. Thanks for joining us here today.
Thank you. I'm so excited. This is my first podcast, so I can, and I've always wanted to be on a podcast, so this is a highlight.
I love it. My own thing, too. I've always wanted to be a podcast host, so we're fulfilling our dreams together here today. So Katie, one thing is I wanted to start out with you here. I mentioned before in a little bit of intro, you're a graduate gemologist, and you're currently curating the Edward Metzger Gem Collection at the Johnson Museum. Can you tell me a little bit, what does it mean to be a graduate gemologist? What is that?
So I attended the Gemological Institute of America, which has a bunch of locations all around the world. There's one in New York City. And it was, I believe it was an 8-month program. And the way it works is the first month and a half you study diamonds, going into color, clarity, all of that, learning about inclusions, how to grade diamonds. And then the second component, which was my favorite part, was looking at colored stones. And there are hundreds of different types. And I learned the ins and outs of them, which was a lot of fun. And it's been so much fun to curate this gem collection. I can't wait for it to launch soon.
Very cool. So I think that's the other thing I wanted to learn about a little more. So curating a gem collection, curating something at a museum. I used to work in museums myself, kind of a shared interest in that museum world. Tell me a little about how you got involved in the curation project with this collection at the Johnson Museum.
So I was at a Johnson Museum event, and one of the staff members was asking me what I did, and I mentioned I was a jewelry designer, and then they asked what I studied at Cornell, thinking I would say art or something, and I was like, nope, government. And they asked me, they're like, how did you go from a government major to a jewelry designer? And I mentioned that I had gotten a gemology degree. And lo and behold, a couple of weeks later, there was a staff meeting and they were talking about putting the collection on display. And they said, well, you know, we need a gemologist. And the person I had been talking to said, well, I actually just met a Cornellian who is a gemologist. And I already had obviously known a lot of the people at the museum through my volunteer work. And so I sat down with Stephanie Wiles, the then director of museum. We went to the gem collection up at the Museum of Natural History, which is not as cool as ours. although they have a huge red diamond, so it's worth going, but and then we started working on it. It's been a whole process. I've learned so much about how museums work and how curating works. I am extremely lucky. I don't know if this is how it always is, but I've been kind of given full creative freedom. We obviously check in a lot, and there have been, you know, constraints in terms of how to mount stuff and displays, but withstanding all of that, they've kind of let me do my thing. So it's very colorful and it's organized like a rainbow, which is my jam. And I think my favorite part has been trying everything on, though. Like, that's a big part of it for me. It's important that I know how everything looks, how the rings look, you know, especially there's an emerald one that I definitely would just work on it and have it on.
Very cool. So in the curation process, could you tell me about like your process? How did you come up with a theme? I don't know a lot about curation itself. So tell me a little about how you came up with a theme for this exhibition.
So when I first started, I started just organizing by category. So there are 844 pieces in the collection, and it's a combination of watches, cufflinks. I should actually step back. It's a private collection from Edward Metzger. Okay. Upon his death, he gave his collection to Cornell. And so it's cufflinks he wore, watches he wore, his wife's jewelry, and then also a lot of loose gemstones. And it skews heavily on the loose gemstones. So there's a giant catalog that I flipped through a couple of times and familiarized myself with things. And the catalog was organized by type of gem. And I decided to keep that inherent in the organization. So when you're looking in the case, everything is organized by the type. And then I put in my own creative spin by organizing by color and figuring out where different pieces were going to be. And I did work very closely with some people at the museum to just get their approval on where things would be, and not necessarily focused on what was the most valuable, but what was the rarest and also what was the most aesthetically interesting. And yeah, that's what I've been doing.
What's something that you think, so I think this is always funny because it's your story about someone else's collection.
Yeah,
right?
I wish I had gotten to meet him. Judging from some of his cufflinks, he was quite an eccentric character. So I have these ideas of what he was probably like and what his life was like. I'm learning about new categories of men's jewelry. I didn't know about tie tacks until seeing his collection. And he actually has a blue diamond tie tack. And blue diamonds are extraordinarily rare. And I can just imagine, where would you go wearing a blue diamond tie tack? And also he had these 6 carats each brown diamond cufflinks. And I'm like, that's a statement for sure.
What's some of the most surprising things that you found from the collection? So you talk about this blue diamond tie tack. Are there any other unique pieces that you're like, huh, I've never seen anything like this before?
It was really, the most fun I had was the diamonds. So they have, Edward had every color of the rainbow diamond. And most people don't actually realize, they know diamonds are colorless. Also, yellow you see a lot. We've started to see brown and black in the market. But people don't know there's red, orange, green, obviously blue, pink, purple, gray. Actually, the gray diamond is one of my favorites. And there's also a white diamond, which is really very cool.
What's different about white than clear?
Well, I know. And that's something that when I was going to gemology school, I was like, I thought those were the same. So the normal diamonds that you're used to are considered colorless because they're somewhat obviously they've been cut so you can't see right through them, but they are transparent. Versus white, it's kind of like a milky appearance.
Okay.
It's really cool. When it opens, I'll give you a private tour. And anyone else listening to this podcast,
love it.
Send the tour to you as well.
curation is something I hear the word curated experience, right? A lot of times that's kind of a big buzzword that's going along. Having curated your own exhibition now in this process, what's something that surprised you about the curation process? Something that you didn't know before?
There were a lot of workarounds with mounting, and it's something that now when I go into museums, I'm really aware of how things are mounted because you're dealing with such precious pieces and making sure that you're not doing anything to damage them. Also thinking about long-term, the case that everything's in was custom made. It's got bulletproof glass and special anti-glare glass and all of this. And fortunately with all of these gemstones, for the most part, they're incredibly durable and they'll last for generations. But there are some like pearls, for example, and opals. Opals especially have to have a certain amount of humidity because they're of their water content. Which is an interesting fun fact. And then pearls as well, you have to be really careful because they can get damaged very easily. So also keeping that integrity in it. But I would say how things are displayed. When we went to the museum, Stephanie Wiles and I went to the Museum of Natural History to check things out. We were like, oh yeah, we want to do it just like this with all these individual mountings. And we like go back and talk to the curation team at the museum. We're like, yeah, every single stone, they're all different sizes. We want mountings for all of them. Quickly learned that wasn't going to happen. Even though the Johnson's amazing, it doesn't have the same capabilities as the Museum of Natural History. So there are a lot of workarounds. And honestly, it was so much fun to be with the team. Underneath In the basement of the Johnson, they have this amazing, basically construction, like warehouse where they're making all of these displays. And it was so much fun. I would mention a shelf that I needed and it would magically appear like an hour later. And the coolest. And I was like, can you build me something for my apartment as well? No, kidding. But yeah.
I love it too. I would say the folks in the shop, I love. So when I worked at a kids science museum as well too, and the shop produces some of the most amazing things. It's like I said, the technical expertise behind making things just kind of happen. Versus, yeah. You walk by, you've been to a museum, you walk by things, you just see it. And being behind the scenes, I think you appreciate, as you mentioned, just the technical expertise that goes into making something just seem flawless. Right?
Yeah, it's incredible. And actually, a plug for MoMA has a wonderful YouTube series about behind the scenes, and they especially focused on the renovation. And it was fascinating. It's also one of the scariest things I've seen, because there's an episode where they're moving Starry Night. And they're just like, it's on wheels. And I felt like my breath stopped. I was like, this is crazy. Actually, speaking of which, one of the highlights of my curation was some of the gems were in Snee Hall, which is across campus. And we had to bring them to the Johnson. And I'm thinking that I'm just going to walk across with this box of stuff. And they were like, no, you're going to need a campus police escort. And I was so excited. I made them take a photo of me in the police car. And it was the best. And I was like, what about handcuffs? And they were like, Katie, let's just get you to the museum. But it was so much fun. Also, campus police, they're delightful.
They're great stuff. I remember, I think I have a coupon for a free ride along with Kathy Zoner that I never used before I left. So I gotta go back and take advantage of that. Kathy, if you're listening.
She's a really big celebrity. I get her emails.
Love CZ. Oh,
that's amazing. Ugh. To the kids, don't interact with campus police. You don't want to get into trouble, but you have to ride in the car for other purposes. It's a lot of fun.
Exactly. I love behind the scenes stuff, because I think those are the things that we don't often get, right? So you had, getting campus security to escort you with all the gems and stuff. What other behind the scenes things did you experience while doing this project with the museum?
So they would always give me a security guard, which felt incredibly cool as well. I think when I got so excited about this job, I was just like, who did we hire? But I got one of the guys who I was with a lot was named Bob. And Bob, he's since retired and moved down to Florida. I have an open invitation to come over for dinner anytime. Bob was the absolute best. His kids were around my age, so he was kind of like my gem dad. And it was a lot of fun actually teaching all the security guards what stones were. And one thing I do is whenever anyone would come visit me in the room, because it's in an enclosed room on the second floor, I would ask people to pick their favorite item, which was always interesting. And one of the guys in the curating shop, he liked this one stone. It was like the cheapest, it wasn't valuable at all. And I was like, are you kidding me? I was like, there are diamonds right here. Bob loved the yellow diamond ring, which is featured prominently in the middle of the case. And Bob would also help me sometimes, because I would be in the middle of, there was so much trial and error with how things were put together. And I would periodically look over at Bob and he would sometimes just shake his head and be like, no, that's not it. And it's like, thanks, Bob. So whenever anyone goes and sees the tie tacks, that was like 95% Bob's creativity there. But he was the absolute best. That was a lot of fun.
Very cool. I love that. So you said Bob's favorite, is that the yellow diamond there. What is your favorite gem out of that whole collection?
There is an emerald cabochon ring, and a cabochon it's a flat back with a dome. And it's got, diamonds around it. It can be turned into a pendant, which I don't think is good. So I like it as the ring, and it fits perfectly. And at one point I was joking with Stephanie Wiles. I was like, if you don't, you can just give this to me as like compensation. And that's not how it works, but I gave the offer. Stephanie's favorite piece was a pink diamond ring. So whenever she came down, I let her try it on.
Very cool.
It was a really formal, it was a formal environment, what can I say?
I love it. I think those are some of the things too, you know, when you have such a good team and that good collaboration around you, it really shows in like the work that comes out of it, right? There's a lot of joy and celebration in that work too.
I love the people at the museum. I was like, can I just come work here and just not like, just do my thing, but just hang out with you guys. And my absolute favorite, so Pete is the assistant director of the museum and he was kind of my boss over, I would go to him with most of my day-to-day questions. And I remember asking him, I was like, which piece would you get for your wife? And he was like, I got her a canoe as our, instead of an engagement ring. And I was like, that is great, but that's not helping me here. Ithaca, Pete's the best. Yeah.
I love it. Well, cool. Let's scale back a little bit. You know, so that's a really cool, again, I love the museum world. It's something that I had as a part of my work as well too. Your work outside of this as well too is around your own jewelry line as well too. Let's talk a little about your jewelry line. You found it in 2007. One of the statements I love from your website is her bold statement pieces are inspired by a love of color and world travels. Can you tell me about how your line got started and your inspiration behind it?
So it actually started at Cornell. When I was a junior, I would have ideas of pieces that I wanted to wear, and I would have an outfit in my head. And this is going to make me sound really old. This was kind of before online shopping was a thing, which was for the benefit of my parents that there was no online shopping in college. But I had this one idea for a necklace and I happened upon a gemstone store, which I didn't realize was a thing because I never thought like when you need stones, where do you go? But I was in Barcelona on winter break with my best friend and we came upon this gemstone store. And it was one of those moments where you just feel like your life is just shifting and you've been exposed to something that changes everything. And I just remember walls of gems and on strands and it was absolutely amazing. And I bought two strands of amethyst and I came back and there was a store in my hometown that would help you make jewelry. And so I learned how to make my own and I just started making my own pieces. And then fast forward when I had graduated from college, people kept asking me where I got my jewelry, like people on the street, really random places. And I started to think, oh, maybe this is something. And I very much on the side started selling my pieces on Etsy. By no means did I think this would be my career path, but it started organically growing. And I realized I absolutely loved it. And I had always been attracted to fashion and jewelry and all of that. But it just, it took it, you know, people actually genuinely wanting to buy stuff for me to realize like, oh, this could be something. So.
Yeah. So, you know, your genuine passion, I really hear that in the way you talk. What is it about jewelry and fashion that really draws you to it, that makes you so passionate about this field?
Honestly, it's color. I'm upset, even though right now I'm wearing a very plain sweatshirt, no one can see, but it's the coronavirus days. So I'm working from home. This is a podcast, but I am just absolutely obsessed by color. I'm in a much better mood when I'm surrounded by color. I think everyone should wear lots of color and be happy, like as happy on the outside as you can be.
I would say your blog and your website definitely show off that love of color as well. I definitely share with you on that too. It's a pop of fun and color brightens up your day as well.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. I try to keep it as color. I've actually been more and more colorful in the past couple of years just to kind of counter all the negativity that we sometimes have. I'm like, I'm just going to add some more colorful tassels.
I love it. You know, so you mentioned too, this wasn't something that you set out to do. What's something that as you've grown in the work that you thought, oh, starting this, these are things that I thought, and now that I've been doing this for a while, here's what I've actually learned instead.
Ooh, that's a good question. This started off as a love of design and I never thought I would run a business. That's never something that, you know, a lot of people say, I want to run my own business. That wasn't my intent. It's kind of happened and it has been very interesting. And it's not necessarily the running of the actual business isn't my favorite part of it, but it's obviously what one has to do. But learning how to deal with all sorts of people and learning how to protect myself from, you know, people who don't have the best intentions, and being optimistic, but still being realistic about business relationships. And that's been something that's been very challenging, but I think, and I, again, I didn't start off thinking that this is what I would be doing every day. And it, you know, even though the design and construction is a big part of what I do, it's very much day to day how, you know, how to navigate, navigate working with other businesses. And I am extremely happy that my dad is a lawyer and has been very helpful, because contracts are interesting.
Talking about, so I think, you know, there's a lot of entrepreneurial young Cornelians out there. What are some, because I think we always hear like the high parts, right? So here's all the great parts, so successful. Could you share a little story about how you were like, oh man, this is maybe not what I want to be doing, and where you were in that space and kind of how you worked through that?
Yeah, that, you know, I've been doing this full time. It'll be 7 years in April, and there have definitely been a lot of low moments, which make the high moments wonderful. And as I've grown, I've tried to always stay humble and grateful for everything. I had a really good year last year, and I just kept being super thankful. You know, it's funny, actually right now is one of those moments where, you know, as you can imagine, everything's getting canceled. Actually, right before we started chatting, I had a really big event get canceled, and I'm sort of figuring out how I'm going to navigate the next couple of months when it's my busy season and I should be out there doing pop-ups left and right. So that's definitely been living in a uncertain age. But I will say, when I was around 30, and at that point, I guess I had had my company for 2 years, and I was really at that make or break moment where when you're first starting out, it's okay for things not to sell right away. You know, I mean, in the sense that you're not going to be a success overnight. It's okay for it to be slow and building. But I had hit a point where deciding if I could keep on going with it. Because when I started, I gave myself a 2-year deadline where I said, if things haven't really started in 2 years, I need to rework this and consider making this on the side. And I was dealing with also a lot of imposter syndrome, because being an entrepreneur is something that's now more of a thing. And you know, you have WeWorks everywhere and people are starting their own businesses, but it really wasn't when I first started. So, you know, when I would tell people what I did, there was not an appreciation that I get now, and people now understand how hard it is to run a small business. And it's, so that part's been interesting, but I, you know, I just kind of kept going through all of those low moments, and things always turn around. And I think, you know, as I'm staring at my empty calendar for the next couple of months, I know that we'll get through this. And I just, have learned to scrimp and not, you know, run a really lean machine. I use my oven for storage. I'm not joking. So I live in New York City, so that's just what we do. but you know, it's times like this that really kind of teach me that I'm doing it because I have such a passion for it, because it's really hard. And if you don't have that passion, it's not going to work out.
So I heard you use the phrase imposter syndrome. And I think when I was a student advisor for a long time, that's something I heard a lot with students at Cornell, right? When you're a student, you're surrounded by people that outwardly are projecting all these amazing things that they're doing. We're doing 20, you know, projects. I'm also staying up, getting all these grades. Could you talk a little about your own Cornell experience? And did you experience imposter syndrome while you were there? What are things that you did to kind of get past that? Who did you reach out to? Things that you did to kind of help yourself?
So I didn't know the term imposter syndrome until actually fairly recently. And it's a term that I actually don't really like the term. It makes it seem a bit more, I think it needs a new term. But when I was in college, especially freshman year, I remember the Dean of Arts and Sciences giving our welcome address and talking about how we represented like the top 1% or is something like that in terms of intelligence. And I was like, am I? and I think, you know, just once you just hit the ground running and you keep on going, and it didn't take long for it to actually go away. I think it was just a first semester thing, because fortunately I started doing well at Cornell and I had really good study skills and writing skills from high school. So no problem. And actually, I also think the fact that I'm able to run my own business and can be very diligent, like that started really in college. Yeah. So that's a skill set that's really helped me.
You said you don't like the term imposter syndrome. Yeah. Let me dig into that a little bit more. What don't you like about it? What would you use instead?
That's a really good question. I don't like it because I don't think it fully describes all of their feelings. I will have to come back to you on what it should be called, but it could be called the thing that sucks.
I like the thing that sucks. I would say too, I'm with you on that. The imposter syndrome thing, or I should say the thing that sucks. You know, I've got that. I definitely have given a few talks when we talk with students and just other people at work when I do advising. It's that same space of, you do all these things. I'm like, yeah, but am I doing these things? Is it just not enough? What am I really doing today when I read about, you know, someone else doing this other thing that I wish I could be doing as well too? So it is a thing that sucks.
Exactly. It is. And I mean, I also think in the age of Instagram and Facebook, and especially as a designer, seeing what you see what everyone else is doing, and it can be really overwhelming. But that's why I've learned this wonderful savior on Instagram is you can mute people or not unfollow, because there are some people I'm like, I need to follow them because, you know, for whatever reasons, but you can just not have them in your feed. And honestly, it's wonderful.
How do you balance that? I mean, I think it's huge. You know, you see all the stuff on Instagram, right? Like your world, I think, is interesting because you are constantly critiqued on what you do. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that's just like a part of it. How do you both balance having your own creative vision and the influence from others and making sure you're staying, I guess, on trend? Is that the right word with what's going on?
Yeah. You know, staying on trend can be difficult. I feel like, and this is going to sound very self-congratulatory, but I've been able to be slightly ahead of trends sometimes, like with big earrings. That was something that really started to come about a couple of years ago. And I had already started doing it, which was wonderful, because all of a sudden people wanted big earrings. And I was like, I'm already set. If I had to say what causes the most anxiety in what I do is other people copying me. And that's when you just have to keep going with new designs and all of that. But, you know, it is hard to stay in your own lane. And I think because I work by myself and I'm not in an environment where there are any other designers at my WeWork, no one's doing that. So it's easy on a day-to-day basis because I'm not as distracted. And, you know, I've just trained myself when I start to see on Instagram, when I start to get the feeling like, oh my gosh, I'm not good enough or my brand's not good enough, I just switch to Pinterest. And then the colorful things on there. Pinterest is one of my favorite places to go.
Love it. You know, so you talk about Pinterest as a favorite place for you to go. I know in your bio you mentioned too, exploring all the different museums and galleries kind of around New York City, where you and I both live. Mm-hmm. For folks that are visiting New York City, what is a place that I like to play the overrated, underrated game, right? So what is a museum or gallery you think is overrated in New York right now? And what is a place that you think is really underrated?
Sometimes, so I'm a member. I preface it with I'm a member. But sometimes I feel like the Whitney has shows that I find a bit overrated. I'm also not the biggest fan of the location. It's so windy. The Met obviously gets all the hype, and I truly think it deserves it. You know, it's one of the most extraordinary places. Can't go starting Friday, but once it reopens. And I love the Costume Institute there. I have so much fun with that. And the Met Ball, which obviously I don't go to, but I enjoy watching like on my little computer. I am also a member at MoMA, which I am obsessed with. I love the new renovation. It's wonderful. The Cooper Hewitt is a museum that doesn't get as much attention, and it's
fantastic. Love the Cooper Hewitt.
Oh, it's the best. I first went there, it was maybe 8 or 9 years ago, for a jewelry exhibit. And it's such a beautiful building. Because the one thing with museums, obviously, the Whitney and MoMA are going to have a modern aesthetic. But mm-hmm. building that the Cooper Hewitt's in is amazing. And same thing with the Frick. The Frick, the art in the Frick isn't necessarily my jam, but it's an amazing building.
Yeah. So. I love the Cooper Hewitt as well. See, the big design nerd in me just kind of loves the span that they do. They had a whole thing about sustainable design and ecological things as well, too.
That was so cool. Those dresses that were made out of
the glow up.
Oh my gosh, that was so awesome.
The dresses that we're talking about, they woven in like some kind of, I think like jellyfish something, where they were glowing under fluorescent light.
Yeah, and weren't they also 3D printed, I want to say? Yes. Yeah, so cool. It was like, ugh, I want these. And I also love, they did a fascinating exhibit on people with mobility issues. Yep. And it was just fascinating to think about design, because I'm very lucky that I don't have to have anything that's not, you know, a normal faucet, normal light, everything, but it was just absolutely fascinating. So they make you really think too. It's cool.
Yeah. I love that part. So get your take on this. You know, I worked in museums. I love museums. You also have a big love of museums and places as well too. What role do you think, I bring this up because you mentioned the Met, and the new director of the Met, I think, is doing some amazing new things, using indigenous art in a different way. The current exhibition is about, I think it's Empires of Western Africa,
too,
which I think is really cool. What role do you see museums playing in the world today in our conversations about like design, art, just culture? Do museums still have a place to play in there? What role do you see them having?
I think it's an I think museums can really boost up groups that don't get as much attention. Because if you're in a museum, you know, it can change your entire career. Like, look at what happened with Amy Sherald with Michelle Obama's portrait. I mean, it completely changed her life. So I think museums, and they're getting much better. And I was in Boston in December and I went to the MFA and they had an exhibit. It was all women's art. And I really appreciated that in the introduction, the MFA talked about their own problematic past with not using women's art and also people of color. And I think now more than ever, there needs to be a focus on it and redefining what beauty and, value and all of that. Because obviously, Monet's, everyone knows, thinks of that as high art, but I think things that are hand woven and some of the, woodworking and all of that that goes on in other areas just deserves a much bigger platform than it's.
Yeah. I think social media has a cool role to share some of those stories. You mentioned how it's like the MoMA or something had the behind the scenes about like amazing. Sharing the stuff.
Yeah.
The Met had a similar thing too, where they shared a woman, I think she's a Lakota, I forgot what Native American tribe she was from as well too, but she talked about how, she brought her dress that she had worn to several like dances and things, and they did a whole story about it. But then they also brought forth how like European painters would still be named by name, but then in the museum itself, anything from Native American, African or Asian cultures would just be named by the culture, and often the culture name of the colonizer rather than the names that the tribes gave themselves. And so it was a cool way to talk about this. Like, here's the thing that happened, and we're not shying away from it. It's like, here's the thing that's happened, and how do we change that conversation moving forward as well too, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, I think it's also a really great platform because you get so many tourists and you get so many people that perhaps aren't as, understanding about things. And the more you expose people and the more it becomes mainstream, it just makes all the difference.
Yeah, totally. This is a Fresh from the Hill podcast. It would be remiss if we weren't starting to talk about Cornell. I think that's a great segue for me in that, for me, Cornell exposed me to a lot of different things in the world. I'm sure it might have done the same for you. Could you tell me about like your first time that you really fell in love with Cornell, that Cornell changed kind of the way that you thought about the world?
I did the summer college before my senior year. And I remember there was one day, it was gorgeous and sunny and like 75. And I was sitting on the arts quad. And I just remember having a moment where I was like, this is amazing. This is stunningly beautiful. I loved the library. I loved the professor that I had, and I loved everything about it. And I just loved just the feel you get on campus. And I was fortunate. I applied early a few months later, and I was very fortunate to get in. And so from the get-go, I just always felt like so lucky that I got to walk around. And whenever I go back, I just feel like, oh, you know, I miss it so much. It was just such an amazing, gorgeous 4 years. I don't miss the snow, but...
What's a place that whenever you're back, you have to go back? You have to make it a list while you're there.
The library. I have to go back to see my old study spot, and also CTB, which is, you know, have to hit that up. But the library was my home during those 4 years. And I would switch up study spots and, you know, it depended on the day of the week and time of day. But there was just something about the library that I love. And I still to this day, whenever I walk into a library, either the New York Public Library or in another city, it's so homey. And I actually just finished the book, The Librarian, which I recommend to everyone. It was phenomenal. And you don't think about how much good a library does besides just reading. It was talking about public health programs and how many homeless people, it's kind of their a place for them to go. And it opened my eyes to aspects of the library and also made me think more critically about like what it was about the library that provided this, you know, sanctuary that no matter what was going on, you know, I could sit at my desk and feel like in control of everything.
Yeah, I have an aunt who's a librarian. She talked about how the library is often seen as a place where you just get books, but really in this modern day and age, it's so much more. It's a place that you mentioned, it's access to the internet, you know, free internet terminals allow some level of access for people. It's a place where, as you mentioned, it's free for all. So there are many public service announcements that are done there, public outreach programs through these spaces as well too. So. Yeah, libraries are more than just books.
I know. And, you know, for me as an undergrad, and I think a lot of people had a similar experience, at least in arts, is that was also my social scene. Like I would meet some friends in the cafe and meet up and all that. And like on a Saturday, I would be there all day, but I was still interacting with friends. And it was this perfect, the way the libraries at Cornell have come together with the cafes. It's just this wonderful little paradise.
My other two, so you mentioned you know your library's looking out. What's your favorite library to study at and your favorite campus eatery?
So for aesthetics, I love the Harry Potter library in the 80 White Room. I would go there. I took Walt Lefebvre's class my sophomore year. And I would only do reading for his class in the 80 White Library on Friday afternoons. It was just very picturesque and I felt it was the only appropriate place to read for Walt Lefebvre's class. And sorry, what was the other part of the question? I know.
Favorite campus eatery.
That's tricky. Every year it kind of varied. I actually really like the Ivy Room, not necessarily for food, but I loved the vibes, the long tables, which I don't think are there anymore.
Trying to think of the last time I was on campus too, if they're still there or not.
I just love those super long tables. I would go there with my Cornell Daily Sun and have my salad at lunch. And then when I wanted to be social, I'd go to the Statler. But there are sometimes, sometimes nothing beats just like a lunch break, especially in college where you've got roommates and you're surrounded by people. And just to sit there, because we didn't have iPhones. like the paper you actually had and just like have my little salad or whatever I would have. So
I love it. You and I are almost the same year, and I laugh as well too. I was talking to some either current students or recent graduates, and I told them like, yeah, the Facebook came out when I was a freshman, and I literally referred to it as the Facebook because that's what it was.
You literally could search everyone at Cornell and pretty much everyone on Facebook. I really It's actually funny. I didn't join initially because I was like, this seems like a waste of time. It has been the biggest waste of time. So weirdly wonderful in a way.
I love it. So Katie, my last question for you here before we wrap up, if you could create one new course at Cornell, what would it be and why?
Ooh. So my favorite course at Cornell was on the U.S. prison system, taught by Mary Katzenstein. And it opened my eyes to all of the injustices in our prison industrial complex. Yeah. It's funny. It's the one class I went in with like a very fixed notion of what the system was like, and that, you know, people in prison had done bad things, not realizing all of the issues. And so I would want more classes or another class about the criminal justice system, not solely prisons, but just race relations and how that's impacting things. Because I think it's incredibly important for students to know about that, because I think it shapes, you know, how you view people who've been part of that system. And I think it's important as, you know, employers and stuff like that to give people a second chance. And I think it would be wonderful. And Mary has to teach it.
Yeah, I love it. There's a quote I always refer to. It's the way you see people is the way you treat them, and the way you treat them is the way they are. And I think these types of classes, especially at Cornell, you know, we refer to ourselves as the public university to the world, right? The land-grant university of the world. And I think classes like that are ways that we change our perceptions about the world, the way we better the world. So I think that's really cool that you suggest that as a class.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting. I get asked a lot what I studied in college, and people don't expect me to say government. And I often get people who will ask if I regretted not going to design school. And I have to say the worldview that I got from Cornell, and I also, my minor was inequalities. And, you know, obviously living out there in the world, you learn a lot, but just coming out of college with this knowledge and this notion about how unequal things are, that was incredibly important to me. Because I grew up in a town that there wasn't much diversity socioeconomically or racially. And I think it was incredibly important for me to really critically think about these issues before I graduated.
Awesome. Well, I think that's a great way to end this, really talking about how Cornell has shaped you and your journey and all the amazing things that you've done. Katie Bartels again, katiebartels.com. Look forward to hopefully seeing that curation with the gem collection at the Johnson Museum and catching up with you around New York as well, too. We're going to have to visit some of these museums together.
Yay, I'm very excited. Yeah, we should have a few a day. There's actually an exhibit in May I want to see, so let's do that.
Love it.
Style exhibit. I can't wait. It's called...
I love the color too.
Yes.
Thank you everyone for listening. Be sure to like, rate, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Find out more about Young Alumni programs and how to get involved at alumni.cornell.edu/young alumni and by following our Facebook page, Cornell Young Alumni Programs. Music from Fresh from the Hill was written, produced, and recorded by Kia Albrecht Rogers, class of 2013, and you can contact him at koa3@cornell.edu. If you have questions or ideas about this podcast, email Amanda, our amazing producer who's joined us here today, Amanda Massa. You can reach her at amanda.massa, M-A-S-S-A, @cornell.edu. Again, this has been Fresh from the Hill. Thanks to Katie, and thanks to everyone for listening. We'll catch you again soon. Bye-bye.